What do you mean, everything else?
Just that I won't get caught,
Padme said, wincing. She'd spent so much time soothing frightened people and assuring them the Republic was on their side that the words had automatically slipped out.
Uh-huh, he said, glowering. I was right, wasn't I? Back when we first saw you. You're a spy!
I'm here to help you, Padme said. All of you. This place, with all its secrecy. Do you really think the Separatists will just leave you all alive when they close it down?
They'd have a job of it, he rumbled. Just because we're not in the big fancy center of the galaxy doesn't mean we don't know how to fight.
You haven't seen what vulture droids can do to a town, Padme said grimly. And trust me, you don't want to. I'm your only hope of keeping that from happening.
Leb Jow stared down at the empty food wrapper on her lap.
I don't believe you, he muttered. But I suppose it doesn't really matter. When do you want to go?
Right now,
Padme said, setting the wrapper aside and picking up her backpack.
The sooner we find out what they're up to, the sooner we can stop it and chase them off your world.
Yeah,
he said.
Victory or death, huh? Yeah, probably death. Fine, come on, and stay close.
Earlier, during one of the long, tense nights Padme had been stuck on the boat, she'd considered trying to find Leb Jow's secret door into the factory on her own. Now, as he led her through the darkness, she was very glad she hadn't. For starters, the dry riverbed itself was trickier than she'd realized. Not only was it littered with debris that had probably been part of the washed-out road, but the gaps between some of the larger pieces had become home to various creatures, or even whole families of them. Padme didn't know which of them were dangerous, and it wasn't something she wanted to find out the hard way. Luckily, Leb Jow knew where to walk to avoid unpleasant encounters. The entrance itself, once they got there, also proved a surprise. The door Leb Jow had talked about was still there, an imposing panel set into the wall about 5 meters above the rocky floor, with a small section of the old road still attached to a support mesh at its base. But Leb Jow didn't even glance at it. Instead, leading Padme to another pile of debris and a hidden gap tucked away behind a large slab of broken permacrete. 20 meters and 3 switchback turns later, they were finally inside.
Careful,
Leb Jow said, flicking on a glow rod.
The footing is tricky.
Right,
Padme said, looking around. The area they were in was all permacrete, low-ceilinged, and with fat floor-to-ceiling pillars every 10 meters or so. The floor was littered with bits of wire, discarded cable ties, and occasional whole coils of cable. A second look at the ceiling showed spots where more cables rested in permanent loops.
Is this the service level?
Yes,
Leb Jow said, turning to the left and picking his way carefully through the debris.
And you said it runs under the whole complex?
Padme asked, digging out her own glow rod and turning it to narrow beam. Sure enough, there were no walls or other barriers as far as the light reached.
I know what you're thinking,
Leb Jow said.
But forget it. The permacrete is 2 meters thick. Has to be to support all the weight. And there are only 8 ways up into the rest of the building. And the metalheads have sealed all the ones leading into the north and east wings.
Yes, that could be a problem,
Padme agreed. Only Anakin would be here soon. And even 2-meter-thick permacrete was no match for a lightsaber. If Leb Jow had sent those messages.
What about my messages?
She asked.
Grubb says he sent them 2 days ago,
Leb Jow said.
How long before someone comes with our money?
Once Uncle Anakin gets the messages, a few days at the most.
Leb Jow gave a grunt.
Fine, okay. This way.
The next 10 minutes were spent picking their way through the rubble to a rusty ladder leading up into a conical indentation in the ceiling. At the top was a hinged trapdoor, which seemed to take all of Lebjow's strength to push open.
"The wristbands don't open these service hatches,"
he said as he offered her a hand up the ladder.
"We can turn on the ones at the south wing, but only for a minute or two at a time."
"Power here is shut down, I assume?"
Padme asked as she climbed.
"Yeah," Lebjow said. "And I'm going to have to close this behind me when I go. Leaving it open would create air currents the metalheads might notice. You won't be able to use your glow rod in here either."
"I know,"
Padme said, looking around. The room they'd entered was much larger and less confined than the service level, with high ceilings and windows at both sides. With their glow rods off, the place was pretty dark, but there was some starlight coming in. All the windows looked like they were mesh barred, blocking any movement either in or out.
"I'm saying again that you won't be able to get out," he said. "You got that, right? With the power off, these lids are heavy. Too heavy for someone your size."
"I understand,"
Padme said, looking around. The level was virtually empty, with only a row of support pillars down the center of the building breaking up the monotony. Maybe she could find something useful on one of the higher levels.
"How many floors are there?"
3,
Lebjow pointed across the floor.
"There's a stairway over there in the middle, and 2 more at the corners. Come on, my old workplace was on the 3rd floor. That'll probably be safest."
Minutes later, they emerged from the stairwell into another deserted factory. This one was laid out differently from the one on the lower level, with the space sectioned off into smaller cubicles hemmed in by thin, meter-tall partitions.
"My station was over here,"
he said, leading her through the maze.
Padme followed, looking around. Even up here, the windows were mesh-barred.
As for the factory itself, aside from the cubicle barriers, there was nothing. The desks and chairs had all been removed, along with tools, electronic parts, and basic office supplies. The shelves along the walls were hard to see in the faint light, but they also looked like they'd been cleaned out.
"This was mine,"
Lebjow said, stopping at one of the cubicles in the middle.
"We used to have a few fold-up cots, but I guess the boss took them when the metalheads made them leave."
"That's okay," Padme said. "I'll manage. Are you still going to bring me food and water?"
"There's a water dispenser by the lavatory over there,"
he said, pointing to the side of the room.
"Should still be running. Food, I'll try. But they've been shifting our clean-up times lately, and I might not be able to get here every day."
"Don't worry about it," Padme said. "I've still got food bars. It was the water I was worried about. How are they shifting your work times? Earlier, later, more often?"
"More often," he said. "They cover everything and rush us in. We clean up the mess, then they rush us out again."
"And they go back to their work?"
Lebjow shrugged.
"I guess. Look, I gotta get back. Hooga's already twitchy about someone noticing I've been leaving every night. If someone tells the metalheads, we'll be in the bins and nothing flat."
"We certainly wouldn't want that,"
Padme said. So, getting captured by the droids would get someone taken into the East Wing. She tucked the idea away for possible future use.
"How secure are they, anyway?"
"Very,"
Lebjow said, giving her a suspicious look.
"The bins are in a block, all thick permacrete, inside another enclosure that has just 1 access door."
"Locked?"
"Double key system, yeah."
"Are there any similar bins in this wing?"
If she could see what she was up against, maybe she could figure out an escape trick. If she could, it might make sense to let the droids take her.
"No, just in the East Wing,"
Lebjow said.
"They always promised to put some in here, but that never happened. I wish they had. People were always stealing other people's stuff. Didn't happen in the East Wing, not after the bins were set up. Why do you want to know all this?
I'm just concerned that you might get tossed into one, Padme said. If that happens, I'll want to know how to get you out.
He snorted.
Yeah, good luck with that. Look, I better go.
Sure, Padme said. Get some sleep, and I'll see you whenever you can get back. And thank you, again.
You're welcome, he said. Good night.
A minute later, he was gone. 2 minutes after that, Padme felt a faint, brief draft as he opened and then closed the service-level trap door again. Her first task was to check out the windows. She started with the outer set, approaching at an angle and as low to the floor as she could manage. In theory, an unused and sealed wing shouldn't be under close surveillance, but all it would take would be a chance glance by a droid or one of their overseers to ruin everything. Unfortunately, the mesh barring the windows was as solid as it looked. Whoever had built this place had been serious about keeping out intruders, which just served to underline what Leb Jow had said about the secure storerooms. Maybe getting herself captured and stuck in there wouldn't be a good move after all. A check of the inward side windows yielded the same negative results. If she was going to get out of this part of the factory, it wouldn't be through the windows. Not without some tools, and a lot of time. A search of the entire room came next. Again, her original cursory assessment proved accurate. No tools, no equipment, no scraps or bits of electronics. Nothing. But at least she was out of the boat and into the facility itself. Progress, however slight. Tomorrow, she decided, she would set herself up by one of the inner windows where she hopefully wouldn't be seen and give the other wings of the factory a few hours' worth of surveillance. She would look for traffic patterns in the courtyard, see which windows had the most activity behind them, and try to get a count of droids and the people overseeing them. Though she'd have to use her monocular without its enhancements, lest someone pick up the electronic signature and track it back to her. Still, straight optical magnification would be better than nothing. And right in the middle of that thought, the inner factory side window exploded with a blaze of light. She was flat on the floor in an instant, her heart pounding, her squinting eyes fighting to recover from the blast and adjust to the glare. Her backpack was on the floor a meter away. Snagging it with her foot, she pulled it up to her side and slid out her S5 security blaster. The cubicle partitions wouldn't be much use as defensive barriers, but they would at least let her play catch the mouse for a while before they ran her to ground. She eased her head and blaster around the edge of Leb Jow's cubicle, lining up the weapon on the stairwell. A shadow suddenly cut across the blaze of light. She jerked around again to see a pair of vulture droids in escort formation hover briefly in the light and then rise again out of her view. Her gun hand sagged to the floor as her whole body went limp with relief. So that was it. No intruder alert. No sudden recognition that a spy had penetrated their defenses. Just turning on the landing lights for an incoming ship and its escort. She gave it a couple minutes anyway, just to be on the safe side. Then, tucking her blaster into her belt, she crawled on elbows and knees toward the inner windows. If she was lucky, maybe it would be a passenger ship, and she'd see someone she knew. If so, that might give her an idea of which separatist faction was involved. She got to the wall, slid carefully up alongside one of the windows, and eased one eye around the edge. The freighter wasn't a style she was familiar with, though it had a techno-union feel to it. Two passengers and an astromech droid had emerged and were standing midway across the courtyard, their backs to her, talking with a human who was himself flanked by a pair of B-2 super battle droids. Off to one side of the conversation, a group of 6 B-1 droids stood with their blasters trained on the newcomers. So, not anyone in authority, or at least not someone who'd been expected. Too bad. She shifted her focus to the other man, whose cloak was rippling with his movements as he spoke and gestured. She caught her breath. That wasn't just a cloak. The style, the throat clasps, the color and ribbing, all of it identified it as a royal Serenian cloak. The man was a fellow nobleman, possibly even an associate of Count Dooku. And if Dooku was even peripherally connected with this place, its significance suddenly jumped a whole lot higher. She felt her eyes narrow. Had that been a flicker of reflection from somewhere near the conversation? But if it was, it was gone. The Serenian was heading toward the far side of the courtyard, aiming for a door in the south corner of the east wing. The newcomers were following, the B-2's lumbering guard alongside them. The B-1s had apparently been dismissed and were heading toward a ground vehicle parked in the courtyard's northwest corner. Another group of battle droids was already there, along with a couple more human figures. The light shut down, plunging the courtyard back into darkness. And in that same instant, a new light flared out right in the middle of the first group of B-1s. A blue light. Tight, compact, brilliant. A lightsaber! Even as Padme gasped in surprise, the blade was in motion, slashing with dizzying speed through the patrol, turning the droids into scrap. It finished the last one and closed down. And then the floodlights blazed back on, revealing a scene of sudden chaos erupting among the droids and people as the whole group converged on the site of the brief battle. Only the attacker and the lightsaber had vanished. Quickly, Padme ducked back away from the window. With the Jedi intruder nowhere to be seen, the hunt would immediately turn every direction at once, and she didn't dare risk someone spotting her. But even as she pressed herself against the wall, a sudden thrill of excitement rippled through her. There was only one Jedi she knew who had both the skill and the sheer audacity to pull off a stunt like that. Anakin was here. She really should stay hidden, she knew. But the temptation was too great. Once again, she eased an eye around the edge of the window. Was he hiding somewhere? Or was he one of the two newcomers? He was. Despite still only seeing his back, and despite the fact that he was in strange clothing, she could see now that that was indeed her husband, who was now walking toward a second pair of B-2s flanking that southeast door. Their wrist blasters leveled at him, the first two super battle droids pressing close behind him. Anakin's hands and those of his companion were pinioned behind their backs with heavy-duty binders. Again, Padme ducked back from the window, her mouth gone suddenly dry. Anakin had been captured. His lightsaber was surely gone by now, either taken by the Separatists or deliberately hidden after his long-distance attack on the battle droids. He was probably on his way right now to the bins. And here Padme stood, trapped in a cell every bit as escape-proof as his, powerless to help him.
Chapter 12.
7 times the Chimera had made forays into the same region of space. Each time, they came in from a different angle. Each time, they found nothing. Each time, they accomplished nothing. Grand Admiral Thrawn had failed 7 times. Now he was trying it an 8th. Vader watched the Chiss, listening as he gave orders or studied the displays or gazed out at the hyperspace sky. Madness, an old saying went, was doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. By that definition, Thrawn was clearly mad. But he wasn't. Vader knew he wasn't. More important, the Emperor knew he wasn't. And the Grand Admiral's hour was nearly gone. What Vader couldn't decide was what all this was supposed to accomplish. Thrawn had already agreed that there were no cloaked gravity well generators out here, and any generator large enough to project its effect beyond the Chimera's inner sensor range would be running such a huge power generator that it would practically light up the sky. What was Thrawn doing? Was he really thinking he would find something after 7 failed attempts? Or was he simply stalling for time? The Grisk had escaped with the source of the force disturbance. Thrawn had tacitly admitted that as well. But what was it? Force-sensitive beings of some sort? Force-sensitive animals, if such a thing existed? Rogue Jedi? True, the thoughts and emotions Vader had sensed from the disturbance hadn't been like anything he'd ever experienced. But that could have been distortion caused by the hibernation process. Were the Grisk hiding some Jedi from Imperial justice? Was Thrawn helping them? Unthinkable. Thrawn had sworn loyalty to the Emperor and the Empire. Such a betrayal would be treason. And yet... Thrawn had claimed that his failure to capture or kill Kanan Jarrus at Adalon had been due to the strange creature that had unexpectedly intervened in the battle. The reports from the Death Trooper Guard had appeared to corroborate that. But what if they were wrong? What if Thrawn had deliberately allowed Jarrus to escape? Ahead, the hyperspace sky became star lines and collapsed back into stars.
Navigation mark! Pharaoh snapped. Sensors at full range!
No objects in range,
the sensor officer reported.
Very good, Thrawn said. Again.
Yes, sir, Pharaoh said. Helm, new course on board. Execute.
Yes, Commodore.
The Chimera began wheeling around in preparation for its return to hyperspace. Abruptly, Vader came to a decision. 8 failures now on record, and the hour Thrawn had begged for was nearly over.
Admiral?
Thrawn turned to face him. What he saw in Vader's stance, or what he'd heard in Vader's voice, apparently warned him this was serious.
Yes, my lord.
We will speak.
Again, the Grand Admiral knew better than to argue. He nodded and gestured Vader toward the forward viewport, where they would be out of earshot of Pharaoh and the men and women in the crew pits. Vader strode past him, sensing Pharaoh's sudden uneasiness as his cloak brushed her shoulder. Thrawn turned again as Vader passed, and the two of them continued on, walking shoulder to shoulder. Vader stopped an arm's length from the viewport. Thrawn, again with proper deference, waited until then to also stop. For a moment, they stood in silence, still shoulder to shoulder, gazing out at the mottled hyperspace sky.
You asked me to trust you,
Vader said quietly.
I did, Thrawn agreed. I continue to ask that.
Then you will tell me what we are doing. And I do not wish to hear again of your search for weapons that are clearly not here.
Then I will not speak of them, Thrawn said. But your opposition to this experiment is not solely because of that.
So Thrawn was daring him to come out with it? Fine.
No, it is not,
Vader said.
Your actions on Batu and your continued refusal to speak of the Grisk prisoners strongly suggest that you are walking the edge of betrayal and treason.
In what way?
You swore an oath of allegiance to the Empire. Yet you seem intent on putting the needs of your own people above the wishes and desires of the Emperor.
Thrawn turned to face him, an odd expression on his face. Is that what you fear?
I do not fear it. I accuse you of it.
I see.
Thrawn turned back to the viewport, but not before Vader caught a hint of a smile.
Do you find this amusing?
He demanded.
No, not at all, my lord,
Thrawn said.
I was simply... perhaps gratified is the wrong word.
Vader frowned.
Gratified? By what?
For a long moment, Thrawn continued to gaze out the viewport, an orderly flow of thoughts and emotions running through him.
I have experienced a great deal of opposition during my time in the Empire,
he said at last.
Some of the hostility was because I am not human. Much of it stemmed from the fact that I was not part of the Empire's social and political elite. Nor did I have family or friendship ties to that elite.
He turned back to Vader, the faint smile now taking on a note of sadness.
Not until now have I faced opposition that stemmed solely from loyalty. Your loyalty, specifically, to the Emperor. I am pleased and gratified at the reason for your reservations, my lord. For I, too, prize and cherish loyalty.
Break out in 10 seconds, Admiral!
Pharaoh called from behind them.
Very good, Commodore,
Thrawn called back. He paused, the smile fading.
This will be the end of it,
he said quietly.
May I have your trust one more time?
Vader stared at the hyperspace sky. He should say no, of course. Order the Chimera onto a new course, and follow up with a lesson Thrawn wouldn't soon forget. The Chiss was already pushing the limits, had already pushed the limits, and any lesser person would have been dealt with long ago, both for the impudence of it and for wasting the Dark Lord's time. But he could sense that orderly mind working hard. He could feel the confidence and the anticipation. Whether Thrawn's expectations turned out to be correct, the Chiss clearly believed they would turn out that way. And for all Vader's impatience, he had to admit that he was curious.
One more time,
he said. A moment later, the stars again shone around them.
Navigation, Mark!
Pharaoh called in the now familiar litany.
Mark, I...
No objects in range.
Very good,
Thrawn said, lifting his datapad and transferring the mark to the group he'd already compiled.
Hold here.
For a minute, he gazed at the datapad in silence. Then, he held up a finger, paused another moment, and tapped a new spot on the map.
Here,
he said, keying the point back to the others.
Lieutenant Pyrondi, that is your target zone. Full spread, ion cannons only.
Full spread with ion cannons,
she repeated briskly.
Ready.
Fire.
The glowing red-tinged bursts of green ion clusters shot away from the Chimera, blasting through the area Thrawn had marked. Vader watched, wondering if this was yet more stalling. For all Thrawn's talk about loyalty, he noticed that the Chiss hadn't actually answered his question. Abruptly, one of the ion bursts seemed to explode into a small cloud. Vader frowned, keying in his helmet's electrobinocular setting. A second ion cluster struck that same area, coming apart into the same sort of splash. And then suddenly, there it was. A large cylinder floating in the blackness of space.
There, Admiral!
The sensor officer snapped.
Bearing!
I see it, Commander, Thrawn said calmly. Commodore Pharaoh, move to intercept and retrieve.
Yes, sir, Pharaoh said briskly. Helm, take us into tractor range.
As you see, my lord,
Thrawn said quietly.
Your trust was not unwarranted.
Vader gazed at the object. It was indeed the size and shape of the objects Commander Kemond had seen in the freighter's wrecked cargo bay.
As you said, it is impossible for a gravity projector and a cloaking device to operate at the same time, Thrawn continued. But the designers of this device knew that was not necessary. At the moment when a gravity projector brings a passing ship out of hyperspace, there is a brief power surge. The designers simply used that power surge to shut down the projector and activate the cloaking device. By the time the ship is fully into real space, the projector is completely hidden. When the ship leaves sensor range, the cloaking device shuts down, and the projector is reset.
Yes,
Vader rumbled. Like everything else Thrawn saw or deduced, it was very simple once it was explained.
Then we could have returned to hyperspace immediately?
Indeed, Thrawn said. Rather, we could have returned until we reached the next projector in line. In fact, that was exactly what happened during our first trip through this region. Several projectors were laid out along the hyperlane to disrupt all traffic.
He pointed at the distant object.
The challenge in finding it was that the gravity well was not spherical, but was projected asymmetrically to cover as much of the hyperlane as possible. I needed to find the edge of the field from several different directions in order to calculate the asymmetry and define its precise position.
The projector's slow drift abruptly became a rapid approach as the Chimera's tractor beam locked on and began reeling it in. Vader thought back to their earlier attempt to pass through the hyperlane, to the hours of travel and the repeated and failed attempts to return to hyperspace.
Why?
Thrawn half turned to him.
Explain.
Why did the Grisk do this? What did they hope to gain by blocking the route to Batuu?
I do not yet know if Batuu itself is of any significance to them. Sealing the Batuu corridor could be a test project, the first step in closing this part of the unknown regions to Imperial incursion.
So they wish to avoid the might of the Empire?
They wish to block Imperial incursion. That is not necessarily the same thing.
How is it not?
The hyperlanes are not the only way to move in and out of the unknown regions. A jump-by-jump method is also able to breach the boundary. But that method is far slower. More significantly, it does not lend itself to the passage of an armada.
Now, finally, there it was.
No. It does not. So you fear that when these Grisk attack your people, you will be unable to bring Imperial forces to their defense?
That is one consideration, Thrawn conceded. There are others.
But none so close to your thoughts.
Thrawn was silent a moment.
We spoke earlier about my loyalty. The Emperor, too, once asked where my thoughts and heart would lie, if the choice came to defend the Chiss Ascendancy or the Empire.
Your answer?
My answer to him then was the same as my answer to you now. I am a warrior. A warrior may retreat, he does not flee. He may lie in ambush, he does not hide. He may experience victory or defeat. He does not cease to serve.
But to serve whom? That is the question you have yet to answer.
I do not believe I must make a choice. I believe in this instance, we can serve both.
We do not serve both,
Vader ground out, waving an arm to encompass the Chimera and its entire crew.
We serve only the Empire. And while you stand aboard this ship, that is your duty as well.
The Grisk are a threat to us both, my lord. I believe I can demonstrate why our service to the Empire requires their defeat. Vader shook his head.
Not good enough, Admiral.
Again, Thrawn remained silent. Vader stretched out to the Force, trying to read the sense of the figure standing beside him. But the Chiss's thoughts were as closed to him as always.
Many years ago, I served briefly along General Anakin Skywalker, Thrawn said at last.
Vader felt an unpleasant sensation creep across his back. Was the Chiss really going to invoke the Jedi's name now?
There came a moment when I had completed the task the Chiss Ascendancy had set for me. At that point, I was free to abandon him to his own task. He turned to face Vader. You have that same freedom of choice. I am asking that you remain at my side.
Vader stared into those glowing red eyes. No, it was impossible. The relationship between him and the Jedi was one of the darkest and most impenetrable secrets in the galaxy. It was unthinkable that the Chiss could have found his way through the barriers. Unless the Emperor had told him. At Vader's belt, his lightsaber twitched, reacting through the Force to the surge of emotion that suddenly boiled up within him. No, that was even more impossible. The bond between master and apprentice was unbreakable. No matter how deeply the Emperor might have taken Thrawn into his confidences, no matter how close the two of them might have become over the years, that was a boundary Vader's master would never cross. He scowled, forcing back the emotion. That couldn't have been what the Chiss meant by that comment. Vader had simply misread it. That was all.
Anakin Skywalker is dead.
So I was informed, Thrawn said.
He bowed his head slightly. Acknowledgement or sorrow? Vader couldn't tell which.
But for his sake, and for the sake of the Republic he served, and the Empire that the Republic became, I ask you to return the debt of my service to its proper balance.
Vader clenched his teeth. Balance to the debt. Balance to the Force. Without knowing it, Thrawn was hitting all the trigger words, and in the process, pulling up far too many of the Jedi's unwanted memories.
There is no debt. You had a choice. You made it. The Empire does not owe you.
No, it does not.
For a long moment, they gazed at each other in silence.
We will continue. For now, what is your plan?
Thrawn inclined his head. This time the intent was unambiguous. A gesture of respect and gratitude.
The crew of the Grisk freighter took great pains to destroy all evidence of their home and base, he said. We shall need another source of that information.
And you know such a source?
Thrawn smiled.
I believe so, he said. Do you recall your suggestion that the Grisks were surprised by the Chimera because they had never seen a warship of this size before?
Yes,
Vader said, frowning.
Are you suggesting I was wrong?
We shall soon find out. Come, let us examine our new prize, and then gather the others.
Seated in the freighter's co-pilot seat, Kemond gazed out at the hyperspace sky. Somewhere along in here, if Grand Admiral Thrawn was right, they would find their target. Mentally, he shook his head. This was crazy. Beside him, Teffen muttered something under her breath.
What was that? Kemond asked.
I said this crimped freighter handles like a dropped rock, the pilot growled. I thought it was supposed to be this wonderful six-tricked surprise package.
I assumed all the cool add-ons were out of sight, Keeman said. Extra armor and shielding and all. He pointed to a section of Teffen's board. Not to mention a pair of fire-linked blaster cannons.
Which we can't use.
Well, not yet anyway, Keeman conceded. Doesn't mean... And even though he was expecting it, the sudden switch from sky to star lines to stars caught him by surprise. Evidently it did Teffen, too.
Oof,
she puffed.
I guess Thrawn was right.
I guess he was, Keeman said, keying for a sensor sweep as he punched the intercom. We're here, he announced. Incoming, two ships, elliptical shape, about the size of Corona-class frigates. The freighter shuddered as a pair of laser blasts burned into a section of hull. And heavily armed, Keeman added dryly. Damage!
Shot directly over the hyperdrive, Teffen reported. Damage, outer hull, nothing else. Well, damn, I guess this thing is tricked out.
So it seems, Keeman said. Looks like one's standing off and the other one's coming in for boarding. He slapped Teffen on her shoulder as he popped his restraints. I'm heading back to suit up, he said, levering himself out of the cramped seat. Don't forget to look scared in case they peek in through the window.
Right. Sitting here looking like a vagabond.
Teffen groused. Don't be snobbish, Keeman reproved her, looking at her grubby merchant's jumpsuit. Most people in the galaxy always have to dress like that. Stay sharp. 30 seconds later, he was in the ready room. 2 minutes after that, he was suited up in full stormtrooper armor. 1 minute after that, he was standing with his fellow First Legionnaires at the freighter's cargo hatch. 10 seconds after taking his place, he heard the metallic screeching as the attacking frigate grappled onto the freighter's side, followed by another pair of thuds as the boarding tunnel locked an air seal around both hatches. Keeman waited. With a sudden multiple crisscross shower of sparks around the edges and across the face of the hatch, the attackers began burning through.
Get ready,
Keeman murmured into his comm.
Remember, we're just clearing the hatch.
The sizzling reached a crescendo, and with a scream of stressed metal, the hatch disintegrated. A dozen armored Grisks charged in through the opening, dropping to one knee just inside as they began exchanging fire with the waiting stormtroopers. A set of spotlights at the rear of the hold blazed to life, lighting up the attackers and shining squarely in their eyes. And through that glare, probably visible only as an indistinct shadow, strode Lord Vader. It was doubtful that the Grisks, fully engaged with the stormtroopers, even saw him coming. But as the attackers began falling from the defenders' concentrated fire, Vader reached the firing line, the red blade of his lightsaber cutting through the enemy like a scythe through ripened grain as he walked through their midst. A couple of Grisks near the edge of the battle spotted him and swung their weapons around. The Dark Lord countered by waving a hand at one, sending him smashing against the edge of the hatchway, then blocking the shots of the other with his lightsaber and spinning him through the air to land on the deck at Keeman's feet. The Grisk had just enough time to reflexively bring up his weapon, his eyes wide with disbelief and confusion, when Keeman's stun blast ended his part of the fight.
Secure him!
Keeman snapped to Veek, looking up again. With the initial wave dealt with, Vader was striding into the enemy ship, lightsaber blazing, heading for the bridge.
Troopers, flanking!
Keeman ordered, gesturing them forward as he set off at a quick run after the Dark Lord.
Commander, the second frigate is moving in. Weapons hot!
Teffen reported.
Orders?
We've got this one,
Keeman said.
As for Admiral Thrawn's orders, go ahead and dust it.
Yes, sir.
And as Keeman and the rest of the squad ducked into the enemy ship, following the blazing lightsaber ahead of them, he felt a tight smile pinching at his cheeks. Let the Grisks try to destroy all the data and evidence this time. Let them just try. They did indeed try. They didn't succeed.
The curves on the left half of the helmet denote a people of grace, likely with a close affinity to the air and sea creatures of their world. The right side of the helmet has been distorted and defaced by metal tools, the colored sections coming under special attention. More than half of the helmet is so defaced, but the marks are not recent, indicating that the desired level of degradation was achieved.
Well?
Vader asked.
Will this be sufficient?
Indeed it will,
Thrawn said.
You and your legion have succeeded brilliantly.
As the Emperor ordered, we serve at the Grand Admiral's command.
The tone perhaps holds deference, perhaps holds pride.
How did you know there would be an attack?
I did not know for certain, but suspected it would occur. While the primary purpose of the gravity projectors is to block traffic through the hyperlane, it is seldom that a marauding people ignore a chance at plunder. When the Chimera first encountered the trap, its size discouraged those watching against launching an attack. I reasoned that a smaller vessel, approaching from the opposite end of the lane, would present a more inviting prize and draw out the enemy.
And that with a proper military response, we could capture their records intact.
His voice perhaps holds satisfaction, perhaps understanding.
The other reason the freighter's prisoners were surprised at seeing the Chimera. Not because of the size, but because they had seen it in the hyperlane and were not expecting to see it again at Batuu.
Indeed. Perhaps that was also the reason all the Grisk ships arrived together. Their leaders feared someone had noticed their presence and had ordered them to quickly withdraw from the Black Spire region.
Yes.
Vader pointed at the row of helmets and weapons on the wardroom wall.
What do you read here?
Perhaps the key that the Chiss have long sought,
Thrawn said.
I believe this is the trophy collection of this group of Grisk marauders. Assuming it is representative of overall Grisk military history, I may be able to use it to learn the location of their home.
Explain.
You see how each helmet or weapon has been ritualistically disfigured on the right side,
Thrawn said.
I speculate that the degree of destruction is related to the depth of animosity the Grisk have for that particular species, or perhaps indicates the length and bitterness of that particular conflict.
They appear to be in chronological order as well. The damages to the leftmost show more signs of age.
Agreed. There are tales of some of the Grisk's wars, a history which I will attempt to connect to these artifacts.
Tales and histories often lack accuracy.
That is true. But two of these helmets may alleviate some of that difficulty. You are aware, I presume, that I have some skill in anticipating enemies' tactics from a study of their artwork.
I am.
That skill can also work in the opposite direction. If I am familiar with a warrior's tactics, I can in some measure identify the warrior's artwork.
Interesting. You have fought some of these species before?
The Chiss have records of many battles. Some we participated in, others we merely observed. I believe I know the species involved with these two helmets. If I am correct, I can match this part of the Grisk timeline with known historical events.
Will that gain you their location?
It will narrow it down, Thrawn said.
And then?
Vader's voice perhaps holds interest. Perhaps suspicion.
We will not attack, if that is your concern,
Thrawn said.
Not with a single Star Destroyer. At any rate, our first responsibility is to seek out their local base and free the prisoners they took from Batuu.
Those who created the disturbance in the Force.
Yes.
You said you would tell me who they are.
If we take them alive, I will tell you. If not, there is no reason for you to ever know.
I disagree. The matter is of interest to the Emperor. It is therefore of interest to me.
I will reveal the secret if we free them. That is all I can do.
All you can do?
Vader's voice holds perhaps warning, perhaps outright threat.
You have sworn loyalty to the Emperor, Admiral. Is your loyalty to him or to your own interests?
That you are not incompatible, my lord.
So you say.
His voice holds impatience and growing anger. His hand reaches to hook into his belt near his lightsaber.
But you have offered no proof.
The Emperor has great interest in the unknown regions, my lord, Thrawn said. This secret is strongly connected to that interest, and to his ultimate goals in this part of space. Vader tightens his grip on his belt.
Is that to always be your excuse, Admiral? The Emperor and his goals? The Emperor is my master, as is yours. Do you suggest I would betray him?
Not at all, my lord, Thrawn assured him.
Then you will tell me all of it.
Vader's body stance holds menace, but his hand does not move closer to his lightsaber. His voice holds threat, but it also holds self-control. I offer a compromise, my lord. I will tell you some of the truth now, and the rest when the prisoners are recovered. Vader remains silent for 4 seconds. His hand does not move in that time.
You ask a great deal of trust, Admiral.
His voice holds perhaps slightly less threat.
I will not be mocked or toyed with.
I do not mock, my lord, Thrawn said. When you hear the truth, you will understand my reasons and my concerns, as well as those of the Emperor. Again, Vader is silent, but this time only for 2 seconds.
Very well. The Emperor has confidence in you. I will honor that confidence. For now.
Thank you, my lord. Thrawn keyed his comrade. Commodore Farrow.
Farrow, Admiral.
Her voice holds anticipation. Bring the Chimera to our location. We have 17 more Grisk prisoners whom you will secure in the starboard ready block.
Not the brig, sir?
No. I do not wish them communicating with the other Grisks.
Yes, sir.
You are also prepared to bring the Grisk frigate aboard for further examination, Thrawn said. I have no doubt that its secrets will soon be ours.
Yes, sir.
Thrawn keyed off.
And now, my lord, he said to Vader, I will tell you all that I can.
Chapter 13. The TIE pilots from the starboard ready block were not happy at being ousted from their ready room and quarters so that Commodore Farrow could put a bunch of Grisk prisoners there. Luckily for the pilots, they got to share their frustration with the First Legion by ousting them from their own hangar side quarters. Hangar Master Zoxton was upset on both counts, though mainly because her routine and private little fiefdom had been disrupted. Rumor had it that she hadn't been shy about expressing that annoyance to Commodore Farrow, either.
This is ridiculous!
Sergeant Axend fumed to Keemond as he slapped his bedroll down on the Darkhawk's common room deck.
What does Thrawn think he's doing, putting them in personnel quarters instead of the Chimera's brig?
He said he doesn't want them taken through the ship to the brig, Keemond said. He wasn't exactly happy with this either. but part of his job as the First Legion's commander was to smooth over Superior's orders with his stormtroopers as best he could. Under Vader's leadership, that often meant a lot of smoothing. It hadn't always made him popular, but it had kept him alive. Still, that was pretty much the way things were in the modern Imperial fleet. So many commanders were busy playing politics, or were trying to one-up each other, or were simply petty tyrants in their own right. Everyone else aboard those ships had little choice but to keep their heads down and try to make it through without becoming someone else's pawn or fall guy. Except, apparently, aboard the Chimera. There was only so much a visitor to a ship the size of a Star Destroyer could learn in the limited time Keemond and his stormtroopers had been aboard. But even from the beginning, the attitude of the officers and crew had struck him as unique. The ship had its share of mid-level tyrants, certainly. Zoxton was an obvious example. But at the same time, none of the senior officers had the self-centeredness of men and women looking out solely for themselves, or the deadly inertia of people simply going through the motions. Everyone from Pharaoh on down seemed intent on working together to do their jobs and complete their assigned tasks to the best of their ability. The reason, of course, was obvious. Thrawn. The Grand Admiral was smart and subtle, but never used his brilliance to show up or humiliate anyone. He demanded results, but never perfection, and had amazing stores of patience for those who were truly working to their fullest ability. He cared about his people, to the point of standing up for them even against the disapproval of powerful men like Lord Vader. Which wasn't to say he tolerated those who were lazy, or who wasted his time, or who were simply uninterested in giving their very best for the Empire. Keemond had heard stories from the Chimera's crew about how such deadweights were sent packing in short order, usually to commanders who also weren't interested in giving their best. On some occasions, they ended up back on Coruscant to stand for court-martials, much to the relief of those who'd had to put up with them. The result was telling. A degree of loyalty Keemond had seldom seen, except within the ranks of his own First Legion. It was a pity Thrawn's style of leadership hadn't spread through the rest of the Navy. Still, he was certainly having an influence on the younger officers. If he lasted long enough, maybe those lessons would someday become the military standard. If that happened, he suspected, the Empire would stand forever.
And the brig is what, 3 whole decks farther away?
Axon scoffed. The prisoners from the freighter are in there, Keemond reminded him. Maybe he doesn't want the two groups talking to each other.
He should try just locking them in different sections,
Axon grumbled. You're welcome to rack with the others in the pilot's mess, Keemond offered. Has to be more comfortable than here.
Which begs the obvious question, Axon said, raising his eyebrows.
Because I don't like leaving the Darkhawk unwatched with alien prisoners just down the corridor, Keemond said sourly. Like I said, you don't have to stay.
No, that's okay, Axon said. Following my commanding officer into hell, death, and sore backs. Inspiration for the troops and all that.
I'm honored, Keemond said. So why in here instead of aft in your rack?
Because I can never get enough air in there, Axon said. Out here, more space. Plus, if I can't sleep, the game table's right there.
Which Teffin will probably have already taken over.
That's okay, Axon said. Heckling Teffin's games is almost as fun as playing myself. Speaking of whom...
He cupped his hands.
Teffin!
He called.
What?
The pilot's voice came drifting from farther aft.
You got any food back there?
At this hour?
Teffin demanded.
Where do you think you are, Coruscant? You want a night bite? Come fix it yourself.
Axon sniffed the air.
Yeah, she's cooking something,
he said.
You want a third of whatever it is?
I'll take a spoonful, Keeman said dryly. Tefford's cooking isn't exactly...
He broke off, frowning, as another sound came faintly from the other direction.
You hear that?
A kind of soft thud?
Axon asked, frowning back. He leaned the side of his head against the common room bulkhead.
Don't hear... Wait a second. Sounds like someone's moving out there.
Keeman pulled out his comlink and keyed for Tefin.
Tefin, drop what you're doing and get up here, he murmured. Bring a couple of E-11s.
Someone probably just forgot something,
Axon said quietly. But he was already moving forward, angling toward the side of the hatchway where he'd have some cover. Another thud came, a shade louder this time. Keeman caught his breath as a faint breeze washed past him. Someone had opened up one of the Dark Hawk's hatches. There was another breath of air, and he turned to see Tefin coming up behind them, three E-11 blaster carbines cradled in her arms.
What is it?
She murmured, as she handed one each to Keeman and Axon.
Company,
Keeman murmured back, settling the carbine into combat position and flicking off the safety.
Don't know who yet. I'll take point. Definite rear.
They headed forward, moving as silently as they could. They crossed the rest of the common room and stepped through the hatchway into the midship storage compartment, a narrow passageway lined on both sides with lockers and cabinets.
A bad place to be caught if there was trouble.
And Keeman hurried them forward through the hatchway at the other end and into the staging area. The staging area, converted from the Dark Hawk's old cargo bay, was wider than the storage compartment, but in some ways was more cluttered. There were restraint harnesses hanging from the ceiling for troopers about to charge to the attack. A pair of long back-to-back bench seats down the center facing to the sides, and narrow equipment lockers beneath the seats. More important at the moment were the large hatches on both sides of the ship that the stormtroopers utilized for rapid deployment. If whoever their visitors were had come through there... They hadn't. Both hatches were still sealed, with no sign of having been opened.
Farther forward?
Axon murmured. Keeman nodded, giving the hatches one last look. There were slit viewports on both of them, and for a moment he wondered if they should pause and take a look. But the viewport's angle wouldn't let them see to the Dark Hawk's bow, which was where the intrusion was clearly taking place. Of course, popping one of the hatches would let them out into the hangar, offering the option of coming up behind whoever had moved into the forward part of the ship. But with only three of them available, flanking maneuvers were pretty much out of the question. Leading the way around the starboard bench seat, he continued forward. Just beyond that final hatch was the short corridor that led past the forward airlock into the cockpit. He was halfway there when the hatch slid open, and a Grisk holding an E-11 stepped through. Keeman had already guessed the intruders were the enemy warriors. The Grisk, on the other hand, seemed completely surprised to find himself facing an opponent. That split second of hesitation cost him his life, as Keeman sent a pair of blaster bolts into his torso. The small victory was short-lived. Even as the alien collapsed to the deck, Keeman could see more of them milling around behind him. And with the flash and soprano scream of the blaster shots, the whole crowd had been alerted. Back! Keeman snapped, firing into the shadowy mass now surging toward the hatchway. He'd taken only a couple of steps backward when the shadows disappeared as the Grisks dived for cover on both sides. The stormtroopers had gotten maybe three steps more when a barrage of blaster fire erupted from both sides of the hatchway. Back! Keeman shouted again, backing up as fast as he could while still firing, forcing himself not to flinch as Axon's and Tefin's own return fire burned past a shade too close.
So far, the Grisk's shots weren't all that accurate, but he had little doubt they would pick up the necessary technique with the stolen Imperial weaponry quickly enough. Fortunately, the three stormtroopers made it back into the storage compartment by the time the Grisk's aim started to solidify. Keeman continued to retreat, throwing open some of the cabinet doors as he passed, using them as a partial blockage against the enemy's attack, and giving him and the others a few extra seconds of breathing space. But it was a temporary ploy at best. The storage compartment was a 10-meter-long choke point, and he and the others needed to get back to the common room where they'd at least have the partial protection of the hatchway sides. For the last few seconds, it was touch and go as the Grisks found the range. But the three stormtroopers reached the common room without picking up more than a few minor burns. A second after that, they were crouched by the open hatch. Keemond and Axend standing on opposite sides. Teffen crouching beneath Axend. "Teffen?" Keemond prompted as the Grisks crossed the staging area and gathered at the sides of the storage compartment's forward hatchway.
"Already tried," Teffen bit out. "They've jammed our comms."
Keemond hissed out a curse. And now that they'd gone through whatever security Thrawn had set up outside their makeshift cells, the only one watching over the hangar bay itself would be the duty officer. If he hadn't called in an alert by now, it meant he hadn't noticed the alien slipping across the deck through his territory. Which meant Keemond and his troopers were on their own.
"Okay," he said. "There should be a couple of suits in the maintenance bay. Go armor up. Axend and I will hold them here."
"Right."
Scrambling back to her feet, Teffen sprinted aft across the common room and disappeared through the hatchway.
"Whole bunch more E-11s up there," Axend warned. "If they find them, we're in trouble. Armor or no armor."
"Yeah, thanks. Got it,"
Keemond said, trying to think. As Axend had pointed out, the bulk of their weapons and armor were in the storage compartment and staging area. Sectors either disputed or already under enemy control. All Teffen would find in the maintenance bay was a couple of suits of armor in for refurbishing, some extra power packs that were being recharged, and, if they were extremely lucky, maybe an E-Web heavy blaster that Ellaby or Dorstran had sent back to be sighted in. But in the Dark Hawk's close confines, numbers were likely to be more of a deciding factor than heavy weaponry, even if the Grisks were willing to let things sit at a stalemate. With a teeth-jarring sound of metal on metal, two of the underseat equipment boxes from the staging area were shoved into view across the hatchway. Keeman's first thought was that the Grisks were trying to block the stormtroopers in, to keep them neutralized at the back of the ship. But a second later, the boxes began to move as the two Grisks behind them started pushing them down the corridor. Keemond grimaced. Not a barrier, a moving shield. So much for the Grisks settling for a stalemate. Still, the boxes didn't quite fill the corridor, and there were other Grisks behind the vanguard. Keemond shifted from barrage to sniper fire, shooting carefully and deliberately between and above the boxes, trying to hit anything back there that was unwary enough to present a target. The Grisks countered with return fire of their own around the box's edges. Axend continued his own volley fire, focusing his attack on the rightmost box in an attempt to shatter it or otherwise end its usefulness as a shield. Which would, Keemond knew, only delay the final confrontation. Opening up one side of the corridor might allow them to nail an additional Grisk or two before the others could retreat. But there were another 6 underseat boxes the enemy could move in as replacement shields. And then, midway between the stormtroopers and the Grisks, one of the storage cabinet doors opened a crack, then closed. Keeman's first thought was that he'd imagined it. His second thought was that the blaster fire had somehow popped the catch. But that wouldn't explain how the door had closed again. Then, even as he tried to get his mind back on focus, it happened again. The door swung open just enough for him to see the crack, then closed again. He caught his breath. The cabinet, if he was visualizing the Dark Hawk correctly, was back-to-back with one of the ship's outside weapons lockers. One of the large weapons lockers. The Grists were still on the move, pushing their way slowly down the corridor behind their shields. A little too slowly, Keeman decided. Well, he could fix that. Fall back, he ordered Accent. Regroup at the galley hatch.
What?
Accent asked, sounding confused.
You heard me, Keeman said. Go, I'll cover you.
Right. Pushing away from the bulkhead, Axend backed his way across the common room, continuing to fire. Keeman gave him a five count, then fell back as well, also still firing. The Grists weren't fooled. Despite the continuing blaster fire, they could see that the stormtroopers were retreating. Their suppression fire around the box edges intensified, and the metal-on-metal screeching grew louder as they picked up their pace, pushing rapidly forward in the hope of catching the stormtroopers in the open before they could reach the next defensive point. There was a good chance they would make it, too. The moving shield had passed the self-opening cabinet now, with maybe 3 meters to go before the Grists behind it reached the end of the corridor. Behind him, Keeman heard Accent gasp and swear as one of the Grist shots got him. Abruptly, the Grist advance stopped. There were two more wild shots, and then their blasters fell silent. Keeman stopped firing. There was a single muffled scream, followed by a pair of thuds. And then, nothing.
Damn it!
A filtered voice came from behind him. He looked back at Teffen, now fully armored, as she crouched down beside Axon's body. Dead? Keeman asked.
Yeah,
Teffen said, straightening up.
You get the rest of them?
I didn't, no, Keeman said. You remember that secret back door to the ship? The one we were never able to find?
What?
Teffen said, sounding a little bewildered.
Well, I think we just did, Keeman said.
And right on cue, one of the Grisk's shields toppled forward onto the deck. Standing behind it, a fighting stick swinging casually in each hand as he stood among the dead or unconscious Grisks, was Ruch.
What the hell?
Teffen growled.
I thought you kicked him off the ship.
Special occasion, Keeman said, lowering his E-11. He hurried toward the Nogri. Welcome aboard. How did you know?
I saw blaster fire through the hatch viewports,
Rook said. His eyes flicked to Axon's body, and Keeman thought the Nogri's expression hardened a little.
I thought you might need help.
Certainly aren't going to turn it down,